May it please the court, my name is Russell Thompson and I represent Brett Adams. This case raises the issue of whether a debt collection letter that identifies the original creditor but does not specifically identify the current creditor violates the FDCPA. This court has also raised the issue of whether Mr. Adams suffered an injury in fact to support standing. Mr. Adams alleges that Skagit violated the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act at Section 1692 GA2 for failing to meaningfully convey the identity of the current creditor, and 1692E for using misleading and deceptive representations as to the identity of the current creditor. Congress enacted 1692G to protect consumers by requiring collectors to provide them with specific information about their debt, as well as their legal rights regarding the same. It enacted 1692E to eliminate abusive practices and ensure lawful debt collectors are not competitively disadvantaged by prohibiting the use of false, deceptive, or misleading representations. Now, since Congress enacted the FDCPA over 40... Sorry, was there a question?
I've got one since you paused. And it's more about the standing issue. Help me understand your client's concrete, as Spokeo 2 says, actually exists in the world that is real and not abstract or merely procedural. Help me understand that for your client.
Yes, Your Honor. We would contend that Spokeo didn't throw out 40 years of jurisprudence on FDCPA standing. It merely clarified the standing analysis. Had it done so, it would have opened the floodgates to litigation, making over 40 years of FDCPA opinions subject to Rule 60 motions for lack of standing. But here, the violations are not even procedural. They're substantive and informative. The Supreme Court's long recognized a legally protected interest in receiving information to satisfy the injury in fact requirement. It's also made clear the right to not be given false, deceptive, or misleading information satisfies the injury in fact requirement. In Public Citizen, it held the refusal to provide information required to be disclosed under the Federal Advisory Committee Act sufficiently constituted an injury in fact. It found the inability to obtain information required by the Federal Election Campaign Act, again, was sufficient injury in fact. In Havens Realty, it found the Fair Housing Act barred misrepresentations about available housing. Even though it was a tester, it found the plaintiff had standing because she alleged an injury to her statutorily created right to truthful housing information. In Keene, an unpublished opinion, this court followed this line of reasoning, finding standing under another statute under the Consumer Protection Act, stating the Truth in Lending Act protects a concrete interest in receiving accurate credit information. Thus, an allegation that a lender provided inaccurate truth in lending disclosure satisfies the injury in fact requirement. By referring to the original creditor here, Skagit's letters either obscure or fail to identify the identity of the current creditor, and this is precisely the information that Congress mandated be provided, thus he has standing. But he even has standing under the procedural violation analysis. The first step of this court's analysis asks whether the provisions at issue were established to protect the plaintiff's concrete interests. Here, there's no question that they were. In Swanson, this court stated that Congress added the validation of debts provision, which is 1692G, specifically to ensure that collectors gave consumers adequate information concerning their legal rights. Thus, GA2 protects Mr. Adams' concrete interest in knowing the name of the current creditor. This is important because the least sophisticated consumer, which is the standard for determining the FDCPA, does not know that the debt collector is required to provide this information. And as indicated in the Act's congressional findings, 1692E protects the consumer's concrete interest in not being subject to false, deceptive, or misleading representations. Congress found such practices contribute to personal bankruptcies, marital instability, loss of jobs, and invasions of privacy. In Papetti, the Second Circuit held there can be no dispute that 1692E and G violations protect an individual's concrete interest, noting it allows the consumer to confirm he owes the debt before paying it, and 1692E protects the consumer's ability to fully avail himself of the legal rights by prohibiting collectors from deceiving or misleading.
From doing those things? I mean, did Adams actually have the problems that Congress, as you just described, was trying to avoid?
Yes, he received the letter, and he was unsure who his current creditor was and didn't even know that he needed to be looking for that information. If you send a consumer...
that he called the wrong entity or that he couldn't negotiate or anything like that, right?
No, because he didn't know that he even had that information. He received the letters and immediately contacted counsel to get legal advice on how to deal with the letters. But we believe that there's still the risk of harm there. Even if the court finds that Mr. Adams was not harmed, which we believe he was, we believe that courts across the country have explained the risk of harm. In Anderson versus Ray Klein...
That's what I was asking you. Tell me what harm... I mean, I can't even pronounce the name of the Supreme Court case. I only knew there was one. I came to the Ninth Circuit. Now I realize there's Spokeo 1, 2, and 3. But as I read Spokeo 3, it says your client has to show actually exists in the real world, the injury is real and not abstract, merely procedural. I'm just trying to figure out how your facts fit within Spokeo 3, for the language I just quoted to you. And I asked a question, you didn't tell me anything, so I'm assuming you don't have anything. And tell me why that's not a good assumption.
Let me try to explain, I guess, again. Maybe I misunderstood your question or simply answered it oddly. We think numerous courts have explained the risk of harm. So in Anderson versus Ray Klein, the Eastern District of Michigan explained that original creditor without any mention of the current creditor unduly enhances the authority of the debt collector. Stated, a credulous consumer might very well be warned away from trying to settle his debt with the creditor directly. This doesn't just hurt the consumer. It illegally enhances the profitability of defendant at the expense of law-abiding debt collectors, which is exactly the sort of unfair competition the FDCPA was designed to counteract. So here, it's the same exact risk of harm. Again, we think there's a risk of harm in that the consumer not receiving the information that they don't even know that they're to receive. We can't presume the least sophisticated consumer knows what Congress told debt collectors they have to provide them. So not getting the information, the consumer is hugely at risk of harm because it doesn't have all the available information to make a determination on what the next
counsel,
step is.
Judge Gould, if I can interject a question. You've been using the term risk of harm, and I wondered how that fits with concrete and particularized injury, which seems to be the standing requirement.
Yes, Your Honor. If the court determines that it's a procedural violation, in Spokio 2, at least when the Ninth Circuit took Spokio back on remand, which I guess might be 3, if decided on a two-step test. The first step is whether the provisions at issue were established to protect the plaintiff's concrete interests, which I believe we've answered in the positive, in the affirmative. The second step asks whether the specific procedural violation actually harmed or presented a material risk of harm. So if it actually harmed Mr. Adams, he has standing, or if it presented a material risk of harm, he has standing. So if he can prove either one of those, or the court finds either one of those, they're standing. Thus, you know, explaining the risk of harm that Congress intended here. That's why I think the Anderson opinion is relevant. I think there's other risk of harm that the Anderson court didn't consider. For example, debt buyers pay less than face value for debts. So this knowledge is important to know whether it's owned by the original creditor or a debt buyer, because there's a risk of harm in the consumer making a decision on how much money to offer. The consumer also has to make a decision on whether to pay the debt or not. If it's been sold to a debt buyer, the consumer has that information to know that they likely have at least somewhat less documents and evidence to prove their case at trial. But not knowing this information or being misled to it certainly doesn't do that. And numerous circuits have found standing under these scenarios. The Second Circuit did in Papetti, finding standing under G&E. The Sixth Circuit in Macy followed it. 4 months later, the Second Circuit again reiterated its holding in Zero Dronis, stating Congress plainly sought to protect consumers' concrete economic interests by requiring debt collectors to comply with the notice provisions in Section 1692G. And in Cohen, which was a later decision of the Second Circuit, it again found standing on the same exact claims here, noting a misrepresentation as to the current creditor poses a risk of real harm. In the 11th Circuit, Church found standing under 1692G because Congress created the right to receive the required disclosures and a new injury for not receiving such disclosures. Skagit refers to this court's unpublished opinion in Davis. We think that's irrelevant. It performed no analysis and was simply remanded because the briefing was limited. It is correct that Bassett distinguished Havens and Federal Election Commission, but the provision in that case did not confer a substantive right to a receipt. Here it did. It was substantive right to get that information. So in that case, they could have printed no information. Also, I think the Seventh Circuit opinion on Casillas is important. While Skagit uses that for their position, we believe it's improperly decided, and the dissent from the denial of the rehearing en banc presents the better analysis. But that case actually still supports standing. There, quoting a prior opinion, it stated an informational injury can be concrete when the plaintiff is entitled to receive and review substantive information. Okay. GA4 does not permit receiving and reviewing. GA2 permits receiving the information of who the current creditor is, and then making the decision under GA5 to request the name and address of the original creditor if that information is different. Thus, it supports standing in this case.
Mr. Thompson, if I may interject, the time that shows on your clock is going up. That means it's time over for argument. So, I mean, we caused this by our questions, but we took you past your 7 minutes and initial argument and used up your rebuttal time as well. But not to worry, I'm going to give you 3 minutes of rebuttal time if you want to plan it. But we'll also give Mr. Messer an extra 3 minutes if he wants or needs it. Mr. Messer, you can go ahead. That's a handsome library you've got there.
Well, thank you, Your Honor. To please the court, Charles Messer with the appellee, Skagit Bond and Collectors. The standing issue is crucial to this court's jurisdiction, and under settled Ninth Circuit authority, I pronounce it Spokio, maybe I'm mistaken, but I call the case a Spokio. The plaintiff who demonstrates the standing must plead an injury in fact that is concrete and particularized. And in the class action complaint that's in the record on appeal, his specific allegation at page 10 of the record on appeal, page 1 of this class action complaint, he says, plaintiff has Article 3 standing to bring this action as it seeks to address conduct by defendant that caused plaintiff to suffer intangible harm. Well, intangible harms, this is a judicial admission, and judicial harms are insufficient to meet the Ninth Circuit's standard for standing of showing injury in fact. My colleague, Mr. Thompson, discussed, is there 40 years of litigation under the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, and the standing analysis may upend that. We think that's a wild exaggeration. The District of Columbia Circuit recently addressed standing in the context of an FDCPA. In the case we cited, Frank versus Autovest, and we think that case has...
Wait a second.
We lost your volume somehow. We couldn't hear you anymore.
Let's see if... Is Richard August listening?
Yes, Judge, I'm here. This appears to be an issue on Mr. Messer's end. I have no indication of him being muted. Mr. Messer, I might suggest that you make use of the phone number that was included in your connection information.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
I can hear you.
Excellent. Thank you. So I think, and I apologize, I don't know why my microphone on my computer stopped working, but I was there's a the recent case decided by the District of Columbia Court of Appeal, Frank versus Autovest, which we cited in our brief on standing, I think has an excellent delineation between a proper legal analysis of substantive liability under the FDCPA versus whether there is standing under prevailing Supreme Court evaluation of the limits of Article 3. And that the standing analysis does not undermine FDCPA liability. FDCPA liability determined under objective standards. For example, does the communication, is it likely to mislead or deceive the least sophisticated consumer? Whereas a standing evaluation under prevailing authority, including Spokio, is a subjective analysis. Does the plaintiff himself sustain an actual injury in the real world, something that is genuine, concrete, and particularized? And so here, the mere allegation that Mr. Adams says, well, I sustained intangible harm cannot be sufficient and is not sufficient to show that he sustained an injury of fact sufficient to give him standing to prosecute this case. And for that reason, the court lacks jurisdiction and the case should be dismissed. And I think standing the evaluation is pretty straightforward on these facts and on this complaint that he lacks standing. On the merits, there's no real allegation that the letter is false, deceptive, or misleading, and so the 1692E claim has no merit. His last the grasp is to say, well, the statute requires that the creditor be identified, but the creditor was identified as Skagit Health, and there is, and if you, and the factors enunciated by the Seventh Circuit in the Smith case were not factors that are articulated in the cases upon which the appellant relies, particularly pointed out that in Smith, as here, Skagit Health is the only identified creditor, that the collection agency, my client, Skagit DeBonded, is identified in the letters as a professional debt collector, that the letter itself refers to a debt in the third person, not our debt, and an important factor to the Smith, to the Seventh Circuit in Smith, it points out that the letter said, well, if you have questions about if you're confused about the creditor, whether it's the original or current, you may contact us, which to the Seventh Circuit informs the reader that they may be different, but here they're not. And so these were the factors that persuaded the Seventh Circuit that a letter that identified the original creditor was not deceptive and complied with the FDCPA. And again, it's not plausible to say that this letter is likely to deceive or mislead a consumer. The letter, as the district court found, is clear to any ordinary reader that this is a medical debt, that the debt is owed to Skagit Health, and that Skagit Bonded is a professional debt collector who is seeking to collect the debt. If the court has questions, I'm happy to answer them. Other than that, I will submit.
Sir, I think it's hard to interrupt on the phone. I'm sorry, but I would like to ask you a couple things. One is, in the letter here, it said that Adams' account had been assigned to SBC for collection. How do we know that an unsophisticated person would understand that the debt was still with the creditor as opposed to with the collector as the ownership of the debt?
Because of the other language in the case. I mean, legally assignments can be for purposes of collection or they can be purchased, but an assignment is generally an authorization to act on another's behalf. So even if you say, well,
the... All the letter said was that the original creditor was a different entity. So if the original creditor is a different entity and the debt has been assigned and someone looks up in the dictionary, what does assign mean? One of the terms it might mean is change of ownership.
Well, Your Honor, I think you need to, on this letter, I think you need to read the word assigned in its context, which it says it's assigned to our office for collection. And that's all it says. And then it says we are a debt collector. And so in the context of this entire letter, the term assignment is clear that this is that we are a collector acting on another's behalf.
I mean, it may be because clear we're fine to a lawyer who is familiar with this industry, but someone who just gets this letter who doesn't know how this works, I don't know how they would know that this isn't assigned to them so they can try to collect it.
Well, it is assigned to them so they can try to collect it.
But if it was,
but that doesn't mean that. But there's nowhere that Skagit Bondard is saying we own the debt, and there's nothing in here that implies that Skagit Bondard owns the debt.
Well, if it had been sold, then the collector would be the current creditor.
Right. If it had been sold, then the debt buyer would be the current creditor. That's correct.
So someone who wants to negotiate with the current creditor might not know whether to call the collector or the original lender.
Well, in theory, I guess that's true, but neither of those things was done in this case.
Well, that gets back to you went to the merits of the violation, but maybe you want to talk more about whether that's necessary for standing.
Well, it would be necessary for standing.
And what tells us that?
Some tangible act, some tangible injury, something genuinely happened that Mr. Adams did in the world that caused him harm that would create an injury in fact, which would give him standing.
Doesn't Spokeo or Spokeo, however we want to pronounce it, tell us that intangible injuries can count?
They can, but you see, but Spokeo did not approve this kind of rubber stamp approval of standing any time a plaintiff alleges a statutory violation, because if there was a rubber stamp, Spokeo would not have remanded the case to the lower court to determine whether there was an injury in fact. And so the answer to your question, Your Honor, as so often in legal world, is it depends. It
so
depends
what
on what the injury in fact is alleged.
Before you were saying that they said it was intangible, so that shows it's not an injury that counts. Now you're saying it depends.
Right.
What does it depend on, and how can we tell?
It depends on whether the injury is tangible.
No, you just said intangible injuries can count. So how do we determine whether...
Intangible harms do not create standing. Tangible harms create standing.
Well, Spokeo said an intangible... I think it said injury, now I don't remember, but it definitely says intangible harms or injury of intangible things can be sufficient in some circumstances, right? So are you distinguishing something between injury and harm? I'm not sure what you're distinguishing.
In our view, Spokeo and the other standing case in the context of the FTCPA, such as Casillas out of the Seventh Circuit and Frank out of the District of Columbia, stand for the proposition that the standing issue is a subjective inquiry looking at injury in fact to the lead plaintiff, the named plaintiff, who alleges a violation. And that on, and then as to this complaint, and Frank says that that's not a very high bar. But in this case, plaintiff has not reached the bar of standing because all he has is this intangible claim based on a letter that is not false, misleading, or deceptive.
What if we disagree with you about whether the letter is confusing? Could you still win?
Yes, on standing, certainly. Or, you know, there's also Donahue that talks about the materiality of the misrepresentation. And so if it's material, and, you know, one of the factors that shows that it's not material is that Adam took no actual action in response. So, yes, I could still win on the basis of materiality, even if you find it, that it's confusing. But I think the better view is that the letter, as the district court found, the letter is not confusing to any ordinary reader. Your Honor, I appreciate your questions. I hope I've answered them sufficiently to your satisfaction. And unless there are further questions, the appellee will submit.
Okay. Mr. Messer, I think that's fine, unless Judge Wu has a question or Judge Friedland has another one. Okay, I have no questions. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, so first I'd like to say that standing is not always a subjective inquiry. It can also be an objective inquiry. So this court adopted the test in Spokio on remand for standing for procedural violations. Again, it's whether the statutory provision at issue was established to protect a concrete interest. We're past that. Step two is, if so, whether the specific procedural violations alleged in this case actually harm, that is subjective, or present a material risk of harm to such interest. So it doesn't matter. Mr. Adams can have standing either way, whether a tangible harm or intangible harm here, and that's exactly what he's done. He was harmed as he pleads in his complaint. He read the letter, and he was unsure who his creditor was. So that's where he has the actual standing. But it presented the material risk of harm, as has been described in the other circuits. The reliance on Frank is misplaced. There, the court actually said that Frank satisfied her burden at the pleading statement by including general factual allegations of injury resulting from the defendant's conduct. That's exactly what Mr. Adams done here. So he survives that. The rest was on summary judgment. The defendant also makes multiple arguments regarding a sign. I think the court should look at, I believe, the Eastern District of Michigan's opinion in Neff, where the court discussed the term assignee and the discussion of the knowledge of what that term meant. The argument that the letter says it's a professional debt collector, I'm not sure what the defendant's argument is with respect to that. If they're arguing that you can't be both a debt collector and a creditor, well, that's just patently wrong. This court has already decided that a passive debt buyer can indeed also be a debt collector, because the principal purpose of their business is the collection of debt. The reliance on Smith.
Mr. Thompson, your extra 3 minutes is almost up beyond your initial overage, so just find a way to wrap up your argument.
Yes, Your Honor. I'd just like to discuss Stefik real quick. As defendant relies on Smith, Smith actually made it most of the way there, but didn't go as far as Stefik. In Smith, they said by informing the debtor, they could request the name of the original creditor. If different from the current creditor, the letter alerts the debtor the original and current creditor may be the same. But it didn't take the next step Stefik did that said, yeah, they may be the same, but they may be different. Thus, the letter's open to multiple interpretations, as this court has said is a violation under Gonzalez versus Arrow, and the district court's opinion should be reversed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Thompson. I think what I'm going to do is thank Mr. Thompson and Mr. Messer for their spirited arguments here. These are difficult issues, and the court will now submit the case with a final bit of thanks for your advocacy. And I think the two of you, apart from the Washington, D.C. advocates, metaphorically traveled the farthest for our argument, so thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Thank you. So Stacey, let's submit this one.